All right, hi everybody, and welcome to lecture 54 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're returning to the Greco-Persian War, and today we are going to talk about the greatest defeat in the history of warfare. So wrap your head around that if you can, and we'll see what we can make sense of that particular thought. Let's just recapture a little bit of the context here. We're going to be talking about the third expedition of the Persians against Greece. The first did not result in any significant attack. So the first was here along land. And as you can see, the land army turned around because at the same time, the navy came along and was going to shadow them along the coast, but then encountered a storm and was a lot of the navy was lost in that expedition, not being familiar with the Aegean Sea and conditions there. So the first Persian expedition was just a complete throwaway. Complete do-over. And so Dariush then organized the second expedition. And so we see that fleet coming through here and picking up its Greek helpers and then heading over to Athens here. And that results in what we talked about yesterday, which was the Battle of Marathon, in which the Greeks used the double envelopment maneuver in order to defeat the Persians, in given the special conditions that they were encountered at that particular battle site. So now we get to expedition number three, Persian offensive number three, and we are now at the stage where Dariush has died. And a whole bunch of things have happened back in the Persian Empire. There was a rebellion by the Egyptians. So the Persians were busy for a while. And there's a new king. His name is Xerxes. And he now is going to lead what probably was the largest army in history up to that point against Greece. We don't have and can't possibly have an accurate measure of the size of this army. The Persians didn't really bother with accurate scientific history, so we can't get anything from their records with regard to what might have happened. They were very prone to exaggeration in their characterizations of their own kings and how great they were and stuff like that. So we can't use anything that they might have to say about it. We have the Greek historian Herodotus, who says that the army consisted of 2 million men. And that is also not a reliable figure. And it's impossible to come up with a good one. And one of the reasons why Herodotus' figures are not almost ever really treated as accurate is because Herodotus had a kind of interesting method as a Greek historian. And his premise was that it was important to report what people said, what they thought, what they believed. And so there's an element of what we call social history there. And so he recorded what people said. So if somebody said that the army had 2 million men in it, well, then that's what he recorded. And sometimes when he recorded something like that, he would joke about it. Or he would express his incredulity. He would say, there's no way that's true. Or something like that. To just inject an element of criticism in his history. He reported this figure of 2 million. We can't believe that one. Modern historians know what they bring to bear in their thinking about it is that, well, to have an army of 2 million men Or perhaps just a combined force with all of the supporting cast and everything, no matter what. What is it that you've got to be able to do beyond fighting the war? The war is just really one dimension of the problem. And especially if it's an invading force. You might be able to imagine a defensive army of 2 million. But what is it about an offensive or invading army of 2 million that is just so staggering? Or regardless of the numbers, just a large army, a moving city of human beings. What's probably the bigger challenge than any battle you're going to fight? What does a city of human beings need? Abby?
They need food and water.
They need food and water. I mean, shelter as well. And everybody has to go to the bathroom too. That's a lot of people going to the bathroom. And so, yeah, all of those things, right? Food, water, what we call sanitation, shelter. How do you... So it's basically a mobile city. And it's a gigantic, what's called logistical problem. Of how do you supply and care for and support and uphold the living needs of an entire city. Cities sit still, right? I mean, a 2 million person city is going to be hard to have no matter where, because you got to have all the farms around it supplying it with food. You got to have a large amount of territory to have that. There was no city in Greece that had 2 million people. I don't know if there was any city in Greece that had more than 100,000. And so, you know, it's very, you'd have to get places like Egypt or Mesopotamia where you could have that many people in one place, because you needed those conditions to support that much life. And so that's what just renders the thought of this massive army on the move rather impossible, really. It's that, how could you possibly supply this army and keep it fed and keep it healthy and so on? So historians are more thinking along the lines of about 500,000 would have been the upper bound to what the Persians could possibly do. But that doesn't matter so much, because that is still more than probably the five biggest cities of Greece put together. So the whole populations of them, right? So it's still a massive army that completely outmatched anything, and just in terms of sheer size, anything that the Greeks would have had. And there was an element here of the Persian emperors trying to use psychological warfare, in a sense. Do you guys understand what the term psychological warfare refers to? You know, you've heard, I'm sure you remember the difference between a cold war and a hot war. Well, now we're talking about psychological warfare as opposed to physical warfare. What do you think the distinction is? In physical warfare, you're using physical weapons. In psychological warfare, you're using... psychological weapons. What does that mean? Timothy's thinking, like mental powers? You mean like mutants? No, the Persians did not have X-Men on their team. So, but Timothy, not like that. What do you mean, Timothy?
Like you use your brain to outwit the opponent?
No, not quite. So, what you are battling here is the psychology of your opponent. Kenny?
Yeah, basically, psyching them out, making them think there's a lot more people than you really have.
Well, in this case, not necessarily. You're on the right track, though. This expression we have, especially in modern sports, psyching out your opponent, right? Yeah, in sports, there's a lot of psychology. Right, and people talk about the way that a game turns on the attitude of the participants and so on. Right, so yeah, psychological warfare is not more psychological aspects of contests are a big deal. Theo,
it means that you are trying to scare the enemy or in some other way make them think something that is possibly not even there.
Yeah, okay. There are a lot of dimensions to it. Ultimately, your overall objective is to take away the enemy's will to fight. And so the first aspect of the psychological warfare here of the Persians was to assemble this incredibly massive army. And that by itself might just take away your enemy's will to fight. They might not even want to fight because all you got to do is show them the size of your army. And what are they going to do? You know, they're looking around at their puny army and they're looking at your gigantic army. And what do? Charge! No, they don't charge. What do? Abby?
Well, they run away.
They run away, or they just surrender. Okay, we give up. Fine, right? Your army is bigger than our country. All right, we give up. So that's psychological warfare in a sense. And there's a story about the army assembling at Sardis and the Greeks sending spies who were captured. And so here's an example of psychological warfare. The Greek spies were captured. Now, normally, what happens to spies? Because, you know, you don't want the enemy to know what you're doing. So normally, with spies, you're going to imprison them or you're going to kill them. Well, here's what the Persians did. Here's what Xerxes did. The spies were captured, and Xerxes had them tour the army and then sent them back to Greece. So, how is that psychological warfare? Good example of it, right? Abby?
Well, they let the spies tour the army, and then they let the spies go back to their country and say, oh my gosh, they have this huge army.
Mm-hmm.
We're totally outnumbered.
Exactly, right? The whole point is not being afraid to let your enemy know how powerful your army is, because it's so powerful that you are so confident that you don't even care. So here, have your spies look at our army. They'll let you know that this is something you can't possibly stop. So you should give up. Right? And so that's what we call psychological warfare. All right, so the Persians, in part, I think Xerxes was hoping that this would happen. I mean, they've already had two failed expeditions. So this is one of those examples of, you know, trying to win by other means, right? And so now they're going to invade, and we got this massive army, the largest fleet, all of this combined, right? And so here goes the navy, and of course, the army across the Hellespont, and they're following this path by land, all right? And so this is their path. And then meanwhile, we have the navy leaving the coast at the same time and going around. And this is kind of a neat little bit of the story. Notice what they did here. I don't know if you can see that font, but remember, Chalcidice is this very strange-shaped peninsula, and this is where the Persian navy was destroyed in the first expedition. So Xerxes had them cut a canal through this peninsula, and they sailed through that instead of going around it. So they were a little bit superstitious of not going in the same place where they had died the first time. So here they come. Right? They're coming down. They're bearing down on Greece in this two-part advance by land and by sea. And the Greeks have got to figure out how to respond to this. Now, we already know, I think this is where we left off yesterday, that the Athenians had been debating this issue about how to prepare. Because there was an obvious naval threat, and there's an obvious land-based threat. So what do you do? And this is another interesting story when it comes to this story of the Greco-Persian War, because there was a big argument, and you guys know, how do these arguments get settled in a place like Athens? Because Athens is a democracy. So what do people do? Nobody wants to answer the easy questions. Nemo, what do they do? Go ahead.
I missed that.
What do people? How did people decide an issue in a democracy?
Cleisthenes invented democracy.
No, I know that, but how do people decide an issue once they have a democracy? Abby.
They vote.
All right, exactly. So which one are we going to do? Are we going to have a land-based preparation? Are we going to have a naval? Are we going to focus on preparing the Navy? Well, society is going to debate. And there are two champions to this issue, two famous leaders within Athens. There was a man named Themistocles who advocated the construction of a powerful Navy. And there was another great leader named Aristides, who advocated the construction of land-based defenses and a wall around Athens and all those kinds of things that you would need to fight a land war. And they debated it within Athenian society. And Themistocles won the debate. So the Athenians decided they're going to focus their efforts on their naval power. Now, that by itself is not and particularly interesting. What accompanies it, though, is fascinating to me as an example of real democracy. So once the Athenians had decided that they were going to approach the defense of Greece from an exclusively naval dimension, or focusing exclusively on creating a navy, then Aristides was viewed as being an opponent of that policy and potentially dangerous, that he politically would have undercut the Athenian effort to focus in that direction, or might have worked against it or done things that would have prevented or otherwise harmed Athenian preparations. So the Athenians went further than just rejecting Aristides' proposal. This is what is the interesting story. One of the episodes that I think is very telling about what real democracy is. And so what this story here on Wikipedia shows us concerning Aristides is especially has to do with this object here called an ostracon. After Aristides lost the debate, the Athenians held another vote, and it was a vote of ostracism. Does anybody know what that is? Does anybody know what it is to ostracize somebody? It's something that we use this word again with a slightly different connotation today, but Timothy, go ahead.
To shun someone, yeah, or to exile them?
Okay. Well, yeah, there's two meanings there. And what you're saying, to shun, is kind of a social convention, right? If somebody is kind of rejected from your social circle, they might be ostracized. So they become somebody that nobody else wants to talk to. So on Facebook, if you want to ostracize somebody, you unfriend them, right? So we do that. Ostracism is something that happens in modern society. But it's not quite the second thing which you said is the more powerful example of ostracism is what the Greeks would do. And this is what an ostracon was, a piece of clay that had somebody's name inscribed on it. And the point was that you held a vote to decide who should be thrown out of the city if there was some poisonous debate going on. If there was something that was tearing the fabric of Athenian society apart and people on either side of it couldn't resolve it, then what the Athenians did was they kicked out somebody. They decided who was the biggest problem character in that story, and they kicked him out of the city. And that's what they did democratically, which is an interesting example. Why I say it's an interesting story concerning democracy. Because in democracy, the majority rules. And that is literally true. And this is an elegant demonstration of that. Because you have a person like Aristides, who's famous and who's well-regarded. And all he's doing is he's proposing a different approach than the majority wants. And they view him now as a threat. I mean, it is a time of war. But for whatever reason, they decide that he's too much trouble to have around. So what does the democracy do? They vote. They strip him of his property and essentially of his citizenship, and they kick him out. Now that's democracy. Which is useful as an example of democracy again, because people say America is a democracy. Well, that's sloppy modern talk. There are aspects of American politics and the politics of other countries in modern times that are democratic. But, fortunately, there are very many aspects that are not democratic, that are not subject to majority rule. And it's very important that those things exist. We generally have, compared to, for instance, the story of Aristides, in the United States, there's a general respect for what's called property rights. So if you've got a house and it's your property, right? Nobody can go in there. Nobody can kick you out of it. Nobody can kick you out of the country, strip you of your citizenship. These things can't be done because nobody has the right to take certain things away from you. They are considered your rights. And those are part of a republican concept. But in Athens, you didn't have that. There was no hard and fast notion of you absolutely will respect certain parameters. There's some things you cannot do to a person, and they involve their rights to their own life. In Athens, you didn't have that. So Aristides was ejected from Athens. And as part of the pursuance of the naval policy that the Athenians adopted. So I don't think that radically changed the history of Greece. As it turns out, Aristides returned later on and he did not hold a grudge, apparently, or at least not to some extent that it would hurt Athens. I think he was a great man. And here it even says, Herodotus says that Aristides was the best and most honorable man in Athens. That's a quote from Herodotus. And I think that goes along with the fact that he was exiled, but unlike somebody like Hippias, he didn't turn on Athens. He stayed loyal, which is a pretty impressive thing that he did. And so the Athenians went ahead and built their navy and they prepared their naval defense. But now we got to go back to our map and the two Persian forces bearing down, and we're going to get to this greatest defeat in history. So here they are coming down, right, by land. They're coming this way. And they're weaving their way through the mountains. Part of why they're going one way or another is because of the mountains. And it's not an easy place to go, ever. To move an army through Greece was never easy. That was part of why it was so hard to unify as a country, right? Because you couldn't easily get from one place to another. And so here they are doing their best to get down. And we're getting to these two, which I hope you can make out. I know that it's perhaps the fonts are not perfect here, or they might be a little bit small. We have two battles that turns out they happened on the same day in the year 480. On land, we have what's called the Battle of Thermopylae. And at sea, we have the Battle of Artemisium. And they're marked here with these swords crossed, right? So, and the Greeks lost both these battles. But, and here is the puzzle a little bit for you to challenge you. Is it possible for a defeat to have a good outcome? Is it possible to have a, in a sense, a good defeat in a war? Because that's what I would characterize these combined battles here. Because I would characterize them as the greatest defeat that ever happened. So, and when I say great here, I don't just mean historically important. I mean great in the sense of amazing, good, fantastic, positive. Greatest ever in the history of warfare. Nemo?
Maybe they found out more about the Persian army so they could prepare more.
Okay, so what you're hinting at here is that defeat serves a wider purpose. Right? In other words, in wars, you have battles and you have the war. What's the difference? Which one matters? Theo?
Well, the war.
Okay, elaborate.
You can lose most of the battles, but you can still achieve the original objective.
Which is?
In this case would be getting the Persian army to go away.
Okay, winning, right? I mean, overall, right? You want to win a war, or at least, yeah, not lose it, I suppose. Or like you say, get them to go away. And so, yeah. So the point is, wars are made up of separate battles. And you might lose a battle, or you might lose more than one battle. But the key is to win the war. So how then could you have a good defeat? What would that look like? I suppose maybe that's not the right way to phrase the question, but in the context of a war, what would a good defeat consist of? Theo again?
Well, I can think of a couple of things.
Okay.
One would be that you inflict so many casualties on the other side that it would be hard for them to fight again.
Okay.
And then the other would be that you put them in a really bad position for the next fight.
Okay, all right, two good examples, right? So one would be you lose, but you inflict so much damage that the victorious opponent, still, the cost of that victory to them is so great. And that's pretty much mostly what you said in the second example as well, right? Because it's just so hard on the winners that it puts you in a better position to win in the end, even if you lose. Of course, it depends how much you have in reserve and what's going to happen next, right? But the most general answer here to this question is a good defeat in a war would be a defeat that helps you to win the war. A defeat in a battle that helps you to win a war. And there are many different kinds, as it turns out, of such defeats. So to give another example, which is a good example of a variety of this, I think this was used a variety of times in World War II, as the Allies were invading Europe, their European continent to retake it. Well, they had to fight a number of battles to force the Nazis to spread out their defenses. And even probably, if I remember correctly, to deliberately engage in battles that they could not win. But sometimes you have to do that, because then your enemy has to respond to the initiative that you're taking in with regard to certain battles and redistribute their forces, and then that makes them weaker in another spot. And then that's where you strike with your massive thrust. So that would be another example of a useful defeat or a positive defeat, which probably not much solace to the guys who are going to die there, except that what they get out of it and participating in it, depending on how much they know about the fact that they're going into that battle, is that they're playing a role in the winning of the war. Even if they're going to have to lose a battle and perhaps die. This is a little bit of a different case. In this case, we have this massive army, this massive navy. They're bearing down on Greece. And the Greeks cannot yet rally in sufficient force to deflect them, to defeat them. So they're going to send a small force to this location, which is a very important location. It's called Thermopylae. And it's a great location because it's one of those small passes that the Persian army is going to have to go through in order to move down into the rest of Greece. And, well, I left you with this thought yesterday, I believe, is where we left off. I said, well, when is a large army not an advantage? Or when is having a large army perhaps a disadvantage? Well, it's not going to be an advantage if you're in a spot like this. Excuse me while I pull it up. Which is what Thermopylae kind of looks like. This is a dramatization, of course. Some of you may be familiar with this. This is from the movie 300, which is about the Battle of Thermopylae. And these are the Spartans depicted here. And they are in their phalanx formation. And so here you have the rock wall of the mountain, right? And then a wall of human shields and spears and expert warriors. So if this wall is maybe 50 people across, who cares if your army has 2 million men? Because at any one point in time, what does the battle consist of? Theo?
Like, probably maximum, like 150 people.
Yeah, a couple layers worth of fighters at a time. You got these guys in the front, these guys in the second row, and these guys in the third row, and the same thing goes for the enemy. And so that's all there is. That's the battle. And there's only so many people that can participate in it. And if you're assaulting a line that's so well organized as this, the first thing that happens is the first guys who attack, they all die. And their bodies are strewn on the ground here, right? And then the second guys, they die too. It doesn't take long for the first two or three guy level, you know, first two or three layers of attackers to die right in front of you. And now it's a real pain because you got to step over your fallen comrades to get at the enemy. And it's pretty demoralizing and it's really a rough situation. And these guys are experts at this. And this is what they do. And this is how they live, right? We know the Spartans dedicated their entire lives to this warfare to a degree that nobody else ever did. So, yeah, this was a perfect opportunity for the Greeks to take advantage of the geography to their advantage. So we have Thermopylae, which, by the way, it's the name, which I know I gave you as a self-test. If you recognize the prefix to Thermopylae is thermo, just like thermometer, or the science of thermodynamics, having to do with heat. So Thermopylae means the hot gates, because it's a place that leads to hot springs. Yeah, hot springs are really cool. I don't know if anybody here has ever been to any hot springs, but I've been to some hot springs in the Rocky Mountains, and it can be really cold out, but basically you have this incredibly hot pool that you can swim in because the volcanic activity way down below is heating this water and forcing it up through the cracks in the ground, and you have this water that you can swim in, which is just incredibly luxurious. And you've got some famous ones in Iceland and places like that as well. And so this was the site of some hot springs, so that's where the name comes from. So the Greeks are going to line up there. There's 300 Spartans, and the king, the leader of the Greeks, is known as Leonidas. Let's see if I can pull up a reference to Leonidas. He's the guy here in the center with the black decorative helmet. And so you guys are probably all old enough to watch the movie 300, although it is gruesome and over the top gory. I don't know. Nowadays, you guys are probably pretty desensitized to that sort of stuff. So I don't know. I can't say that I love the movie, but there are parts of it that I like. It definitely adequately captures the kind of the quality, the character of the Spartans, and the drama of the contest and the sacrifice, essentially that the Spartans undertook, because they were not going to be able to win this. They went there knowing that, and so Leonidas and his men sacrifice themselves at the Battle of Thermopylae. Let me just type the names here for you guys. Leonidas is the king of Sparta who fought at Thermopylae. And the reason why it turned into a sacrifice, although it was probably always determined, the outcome was almost certainly always going to end up this way, just because of the sheer numbers. But in the end, the Greeks were betrayed by a traitor named Ephialtes. So he is the Benedict Arnold, and even worse in a sense than of the Greco-Persian War. And he revealed to the Persians that there was another mountain pass that they could use in smaller numbers to get around, allowing them to attack the Greeks from both sides. And so, knowing that they couldn't defend the pass any longer, the Spartans sent the other Greeks home and stayed and died. But the value of the attack was primarily the delay. Although I think also another aspect here of the importance of this defeat was that on the one hand, you had the greatest army ever assembled. And on the other hand, you've got this small bunch of Greeks. So here is, in a way, the reverse of the psychological warfare of the Persians, right? Because the Persians want you to be afraid of their big army. But what ends up happening? The small force really shows up and greatly outperforms the large army. Does some big damage. So it has the opposite effect in terms of the will to fight here. Who's more encouraged? Who's more discouraged? Yes, the Greeks have lost, but it's a very honorable and very encouraging defeat. Whereas for the Persians, they're thinking to themselves, well, we have a bigger army, but these Greeks are going to make us pay. It's going to hurt to beat these guys. And they're not looking forward to it anymore. Right? There's not going to be any easy victory here. Greece is going to be hard. And it's going to be painful. And it's going to cost a lot to do this. And that oftentimes is a big calculation in a war. One side says to itself, it's not worth it. They give up because, again, the psychological dimension of war. And this started that. This started the trend in this massive Persian expedition into Greece of these demoralizing battles that showed the Persians that they weren't going to be able to defeat this culture, that Greek culture would not submit, that it was warlike, proud culture that would not submit to the Persian Empire. It was not going to be worth trying to conquer them, which is, as we'll see tomorrow, that message is going to get reinforced and reinforced until Xerxes basically decides to go home. He says, I can't handle this anymore, and he leaves. And so this is pretty tremendous. This right here is the wall that saved Western civilization. It was a defeat, but it was a great defeat. All right. That'll do it for today. Tomorrow, we will look at the great victory. The greatest victory of the Greco-Persian War. So, today was the greatest defeat of the Greco-Persian War. Tomorrow, we look at the greatest victory for the Greeks. All right, everybody. Thank you. Talk to you tomorrow.